Welcome to Arts Waves, the Monday edition of Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Charlie Varon, who is a solo performer and teacher, actually, of comedy and of performance. Charlie Varon is currently at the Berkeley Marsh through March 22nd, doing a show called Feisty Old Jew, written and performed by Charlie Varon, developed and directed by David Ford. Bernie is an 83-year-old Jew living in San Francisco. He's very ornery. Does he bear any relationship to a certain rabbi that you've performed as well?
No. This is a totally new character. A couple of years ago, a whole new raft of characters arrived in my imagination, took up residence, and just would not leave. And so I have been writing and writing and writing these characters and having some of the most fun that I've ever had as a writer. They're all old Jews living at a retirement home in San Francisco. And Bernie Shine, 83 years old, working class guy from Brooklyn who has lived in San Francisco for more than 60 years and does not like what his adopted city is becoming.
When you say that all of these characters sort of arrived, what exactly happened? I mean, what was the trigger? And unless you're a little bit nuts, you know, voices don't just come into your head.
Well, for me, writing and performing is a very wonderful alternative to multiple personality disorder. I live inside my characters. I write plays and stories because my characters can go places that I cannot go without them. So they're ambassadors for me into other worlds. Living inside the world of my characters is an adventure, and I don't know where they're leading me. Bernie is maybe the most energetic character I've ever written. In defiance of age, he is full of an appetite for life that is undimmed. He is still climbing the mountain. He is a guy who never finished high school and hates anybody who thinks they're better than he is because they have an education. One point in the piece, he says, I don't have so much as a high school diploma, but I do have a very high IQ. Guess my IQ. At that point, he's sitting next to a young woman in a Tesla. He gets tired of waiting for the cab on a hot October day in the city and sticks out his thumb, and he gets picked up by these 320-somethings. So that's Bernie.
Do other characters speak in your piece?
They all do. This is a new form. This is very much a narrated piece. We were reluctant in the run I did last year in San Francisco, we were reluctant to tell the truth, which is that Feisty Old Jew and a couple of other short pieces that are part of the show are actually short stories. And we were reluctant to do this because for a lot of people, that was sort of a stumbling block, the idea that you could go to the theater and witness a short story, that it could be as much fun as going to see a regular performance. So we've kind of taken the wraps off that secret. They are short stories, but they're very performative. So there's a strong narrative voice, and we move in and out of narrator and character. And it's a form that really keeps me on my toes as a performer as well.
So are you, Charlie Varon, are you narrating the piece?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a narrative voice. My voice, but it is a literary, performative literary voice. So this new form, it has elements of literary fiction. It has the lushness of language that I love in fiction. It has the movement between past and present, between objective and subjective, that is unique to the literary form. But it also has the energy and the drive of a play. It is constructed like a play. It's got entrances and exits, scenes, dramatic tension, and lots of comedy.
Word for word, does stories as plays, and sometimes, like Olive Kittredge,
right,
they work in a similar manner.
Yes, and I very much had word for word whispering in my ear as I rehearse. They've done a lot with the form. What I'm doing is a little bit different in that there's no costumes, it's a single performer, me, and it's very much the energy of a narrator speaking to a live audience.
This is kind of a transformation. I guess in the early days, it was, I don't want to say stand-up because it was scripted, but it moved in that direction, and slowly you've been evolving your work.
I've been working at the Marsh for 24 years now, in San Francisco and now in Berkeley. And I've had this incredible luxury to work over time and develop my own genre. And it has evolved. There were stand-up elements. There was satire at the beginning. I did a show called Rush Limbaugh on Night School, where I played 20 characters, including Rush Limbaugh. But curiously, there was a narrator in that as well. In that show, I began appropriating a lot of the elements of documentary film. And then I fell accidentally into this new hybrid of literary fiction meets the stage. And it incorporates some of what I've learned over the last couple of decades as a performer, but it's also got a bunch of new challenges to keep me on my toes.
When you say incorporates elements of documentary film, what do you mean by that?
Rush Limbaugh on Night School was a Frontline PBS documentary. Tonight on Frontline, Rush Limbaugh, the secret, you know. It was mostly because I wanted to do that guy who narrates the Frontline documentaries with that, you know, impossibly deep and knowing voice.
So it's kind of a mockumentary kind of
thing. Yeah, mockumentary. And then with a show I did called The People's Violin in the year 2000, I was using the autobiographical document, the form I was inhabiting and adapting and fictionalizing.
Well, let's get back, Charlie Brown, let's get back to Feisty Old Jew. So you said that suddenly about a year ago, all these characters began inhabiting your head. Was there a trigger, and are all these characters just like a whole bunch of old people just going, hey, listen to me?
They are not. In a way, this whole project is a love letter to my parents' generation of American Jews. I'm lucky my parents are both alive and well. My mom just turned 91. They live in the same apartment in the Bronx where I grew up. You know, when I did the show in Washington, some people of my generation objected that the characters were not cranky enough and were not impossible enough like their parents. Bernie is a pretty impossible guy. He's a lot of fun, but he's also, you know, a liar, a manipulator, always working an angle, always wanting to put something over on somebody before anybody can put something over on him. But the characters are smart, engaged, alive people who happen to be in their 80s and 90s. And they're stuck with each other in this retirement home. How long? For the rest of their lives. But let me just, can I give you a little taste?
Sure.
Of the very beginning of the story? It all started at breakfast. The five early risers were lingering over coffee and the newspaper when Bernie Shine pulled up a chair, parked himself at the table, and made a show of swallowing all eight of his pills at once. He took the prescription bottles out of a blue Tupperware container, unscrewed them one by one, and dropped the capsules into his palm. All the while, he hummed lightly. He knew the humming drove Al Mink crazy, but he didn't look at Al, just kept humming till his fist was full, and then he opened his mouth wide like a bird and dropped them all in. Selma Cohen suppressed a giggle. She looked at Bernie sitting next to her, his mouth full of medication, and Al across the table, still glaring at Bernie. Men, Selma thought. Men. Al Mink knew what he wanted to say, but waited till Bernie had brought his glass to his lips to make the remark. This is supposed to be elegant senior living, Bernie. Be more elegant. That made Bernie cough and sputter. Orange juice and three pills flew out of his mouth, and everybody got sprayed. So Al, who's across the table from Bernie, we learn just a little bit later on, it's Al Mink and Bernie Shine had known each other since third grade, and they still didn't like each other. That was Brooklyn, and this was San Francisco, but the years and the miles had done nothing to ease their enmity.
Politically, you're political progressive. Are all your characters that way?
Oh, God, no.
Do they watch Fox News?
Well, Bernie is not. Bernie is an old curmudgeon. As a playwright, and I'm still a playwright, even though I'm working in this new form, I'm interested in seeing if there's action or events that can change my characters. If something can happen, some interaction with another character that can change the way they look at the world even slightly. I mean, here's Bernie. He doesn't know if he's going to get picked up when he hitchhikes or who might pick him up. you know, the door flies open and the shiny black car, and he's suddenly in another world. He's in the world of these 20-something techies, the very people he cannot abide. You know, he hates the $6 cups of coffee they drink, and the boutiques, and the bike shops, and the farmers markets, and the yoga studios, and the tattoo parlors, and the medical marijuana dispensaries. But by the end of the story, which ends up at the beach in Bolinas, it's a surfing story, he, I think, sees things just a little bit differently, as do these young people who have, on a lark, picked up this old hitchhiker.
Well, Charlie Valerin, let's go back. So you've got the voices and you focus in on Bernie, at which point you have a character, but you have no story. At that point, is that when you sit down with your collaborator, David Ford, and go, okay, what now?
No, actually, for this piece, I wrote a lot before I brought David in. This piece was inspired somewhat by my friends Omar Khan and Kamini Ramani, who are fans and friends. They had read some of the other stories I'd written, and we came up with this idea that they would invite a bunch of friends over for Omar's birthday, and I would read a brand new piece, which gave me a deadline and an audience, which is the only way I ever finish anything. So I knew that I had to get this piece ready for this living room performance at Omar and Comedies. They're both in the tech world. Omar's born in Pakistan, and Kamini's from India. Two of the three young people in the Tesla are of Indian descent. And so the idea that Bernie would encounter young people of Indian descent and that they would be of the tech world began to tickle me. So there was that impulse. There was the fun of including those elements. But very soon after that, the story takes on a momentum of its own. And Bernie is he is smart, he is fast, and he is working an angle, always working an angle. And for me as a writer, maybe unlike any other character I've written, I am just racing to keep up with this 83-year-old. He is ahead of me. Then they're in the car, and there's surfboards on the car. They've got to get to the beach, and the story starts writing itself. And plot and character and the little thought bubbles that I'm exploring that are going on inside the characters' heads, which they're thinking but not saying to each other. You know, Stu starts cooking, and when it's about half cooked, I take it to David Ford, my director and collaborator, and I read him what I've got. And he says, oh, well, this moment, you didn't do anything with this. Go, do more here. How about this? Or he'll say, this is not plausible. So he asks for more. He offers ideas of his own. He writes a couple of good jokes. And then I come back and we go through this process a few times. And somewhere along the line, I get very scared that there's no way this whole crazy farce is going to, it's going to, the plane's going to crash, the whole thing's going to fail, which, you know, is a little more pressure, and always trying to look for what are the moments where comedy and character and conflict all converge. And I'm trying to, you know, make it work. I mean, as you heard in that little excerpt, I'm getting to play around with something I haven't had a chance to do as a solo performer in the past. Literary language, what's going on inside characters' heads, in their minds and memories, as well as the objective action.
Is there any difference in terms of writing things down? I mean, does it read like a short story as opposed to a play?
It has to meet these requirements. One, it has to be something that will work as spoken, as performed. There have to be moments that are energized and full and alive, not just a kind of flat reading. It has to work in the form of the short story, and it has to have the ingredients of a play, which is scenes where things are happening and characters are stuck with each other in the same space. And it's interesting to have a car, a hitchhiker and three passengers in a car in the confined space of this very fancy Tesla, which happens to have a cappuccino maker in the dashboard.
That is something that a film or a regular play can't really do, because if you're confining people into that tiny space, that doesn't work. But if you're telling the story, of course, different story.
Right. And at one point, Bernie, he closes his eyes and pretends to be asleep and overhears these kids in the front seat talking about him. One of them thinks he has Alzheimer's. And so he knows, and the audience knows, what the kids are saying, but they don't. They think he's not hearing because they think he's asleep. I know this as a playwright. This is the foundation of farce, is having characters know stuff that other people don't. It's a joyous kind of experiment for me in trying to bring together these different forms, theater, performance, short story, comedy.
On your website, charlievaron.com, you list, it's a lot of stuff. You could actually take a course just reading what's there. 10 commandments of comedy. If at some point you violated your own rules, I mean, what do you do about that? Or do you kind of go, well, maybe the rules need to be changed?
I like it when I violate. That's the, I mean, one of the pleasures of middle age is you get to break your own rules and see if you can pull it off. In a way, I mean, that's this whole show, Feisty Old Jew, is a kind of dare. In terms of form, I mean, we haven't really talked about
content.
What it's saying about the political situation in San Francisco and the Bay Area. But in terms of form, it was a dare. Can I make this work with all these different elements?
You go back and look at all of your works, and there are themes that run through them, one of which is the survival of the American Jew in a progressive modern society is probably, I would say, overriding most of the others.
I never think thematically. I always just go from my gut and my instinct and from what's fun and what's alive and a voice of a character. In fact, you know, when we were working on The People's Violin, we'd been working on this play for a couple of years. And he said, well, you know, since this is a play about Jewish identity. And I said, it is. You know, I'm not naturally a thematic person. But, yes, I have detected there is a Jewish element that keeps popping up. I think as I do sort of step back and look at these characters and look at Bernie and Selma and Al Mink, a lot of them are East Coast Jews who have moved to San Francisco. There's one native San Franciscan in this whole cycle of work. But I'm certainly now wrestling with the Jewish American experience roughly from, you know, the Depression to the present. I mean, for Bernie, here he is. He's walking down the street in San Francisco, and there's, you know, the moshishi, overpriced, rarefied, the boutiques and the hipsters and all the excess. This is a guy who grew up with nothing in Brooklyn in the 30s. What does this city look like to a man like that? Is, you know, this is one of the experiments that I'm trying to run in my imagination.
Let's go a little more into these themes. Given that your website is absolutely filled with ideas about American Jews and, you know, their relationship to the world at large and older Jews as well. There's something you mentioned there which I found really fascinating. Shtetl Kitsch.
Oh, yes, Shtetl Kitsch. Well, that's from my show Rabbi Sam. And Rabbi Sam was a character who wants to reinvent American Judaism. His vision is that religion should be like jazz. It should be an improvisation on tradition. He rails against what he calls museum Judaism. Gutless, going through the motions. You know what I'm talking about, museum Judaism. And you know what the worst is? When they throw in just a pinch of that shtetl kitsch. Oh, it's almost Shabbos, and the hardworking papa has almost enough money to buy a chicken. And he says, I promise I will never indulge in nostalgia. Yeah, it's a problem. Every generation has, no matter what the tradition or ethnicity, has the question of what do you save and what do you throw away? What do you inhabit and what do you abandon? I think sometimes this nostalgic looking back is instead of an embracing of the current moment. My characters are extreme. You know, they're often extreme voices that I don't completely agree with. I'm not as certain as Rabbi Sam that we want to turn our back entirely on the shtetl. You know, and especially as I grow older, I'm more interested in, you know, what part of that heritage has come down to me in some way I may not have even been aware of. My friend Mark Fisher says, you know, what threads from the overcoat of our ancestors do we want to do something with? What makes sense? And I think, you know, everybody's going to find different answers to that question. There's no pat answer to any of it.
Well, one way to deal with some of these issues, and you talk about it in a philosophy section of your website, Charlie Baron, you talk about The difference between storytelling and postmodern storytelling, because it seems that when you go postmodern, you're taking a step back and trying to look at the picture, and at the same time, you're kind of removing the heart from the picture.
Oh, yes. Well, I wrote that a long time ago, and let me see if I still agree with that. Yes, I think, and I get in trouble for this because, you know, when I have to look for examples, people say, what do you mean by postmodern storytelling? And, I mean Laurie Anderson. I mean David Sedaris, which is not to say I haven't enjoyed their work, but I feel there's something missing at the center. There's a distant observation. There's, to my mind, a lack of jumping into life with both feet. I sense that in the attempt to sort of step outside of the mainstream, there's been a stepping out so far that there's no conviction left. There's no sense of what you do stand for, or there's no love for characters. I mean, that's having stood on stages for decades now and having lived inside characters, the one thing I can say for sure about this craft is that if I don't love my characters, I don't want to walk on that stage.
Well, you have to live with them, too.
You have to live with them. I'm not saying that it's a simple love, but that's what I find missing in a lot of postmodern storytelling, is there isn't a kind of intimacy and love for character. There isn't that kind of full-bore, juicy, messy love.
In another one of your essays, you talk about flattering the audience, and
you read that whole website. My God, I've forgotten all these things you're making, reminding me of these things I once thought.
That one resonated because how do you get audiences to attend a performance if you're not on some level flattering them, if you're not on some level saying to them, hey, you in the audience and us on stage, we're all right on.
Right, and one of the reasons I feel so proud of The Marsh, which is, you know, just hit 25 years in its existence, is that I think there's an authenticity that we cultivate in the work that we put on stage, and I've been, you know, had a really blessed career, not just as a performer, but as teacher and director, is to try to get work that goes as deep as we possibly can, each artist's voice expressed as fully and beautifully as possible, and trusting that if we do that work well, the audience will find their way into it, and we do not have to flatter the audience.
Are you ever afraid of crossing the line?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a temptation, but to me, going deeper is always more interesting to me and more compelling artistically and a better place to put myself. But, you know, there is the, we're still trying to sell tickets, you know. We're still trying to fill up the theater.
Well, this is also comedy, and, you know, comedy, I don't want to say it flatters the audience, but it makes the audience laugh.
Yeah, well, I think there's all kinds of comedy, without getting too analytical. At its best, I think comedy brings people together, and there is that extraordinary sense of togetherness, of something communal being shared. I felt this, I mean, the time I felt it first, most strongly in my early years was doing Rush Limbaugh and Night School, where, you know, we were all so, so pissed at the right. That was the Contract on America, 1994, 95. And, people at the Marsh, they got to come together and not only hear each other laugh, but at the San Francisco Marsh, there's enough spill on the audience they could see each other laugh. And there's something that's kind of magical, and it's a sort of something almost spiritual about that.
Well, I think 1995 was pretty early on. I mean, since then we've had, you know, the truth tellers of Comedy Central. We've had Colbert and Stewart.
And John Oliver, my favorite, who, to my mind, is the greatest satirist of our time. If you watch his pieces twice or three times and notice the intellectual rigor, notice how his thoughts are built, how the argument is built. There's an almost philosophical rigor to the work, all the while he's got this goofy sort of teenage smile thing going on. It's a pretty wonderful cocktail.
On your website, you know, you list influences. You know, the ones you name are basically radio people from your early days, you know, whether it be Paul Harvey or Long John Nebel or Gene Shepherd.
Gene Shepherd.
More currently, who are the people that you look up to besides, say, John Oliver?
You know, as I'm moving into fiction, I'm reading short fiction. There are a couple of writers who have really inspired me. One is John Cheever. Not most of his stuff, just a couple of stories are beautifully constructed and quite surprising and deep. There's a story he did called The Angel of the Bridge. There's a writer named Edward Delaney who has a beautiful, beautiful short story called The Drowning, which just in terms of how much you can create a world in a short story, I've taken great inspiration from that. Grace Paley still is a huge influence. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man. We think of the form of fiction as a something you read on the page, but there is so much oral energy in the sense of the black oral traditions, preaching, street speaking, the dozens. It's all coming through very strongly. And that, you know, as somebody who is so audio sensitive, such an audio person, to see that kind of spoken energy popping off of a page is thrilling to me.
What do you think of Mike Daisy?
No comment. All right, you've backed me into a corner. You know, his craft is gorgeous. I think his show about, I've forgotten the title.
iPhones?
The one about, you know, it was politically very important, and the way he handled the scandal was shameless and unconscionable. You know, I'm really reluctant. The risk it takes to walk on stage as a solo performer is enormous, the vulnerability. So I'm really, you know, I'm very reluctant to say things that are deeply critical. I've talked a lot about it with Dan Hoyle, who I collaborate with and direct and who does documentary theater. But his work is always very clear. You know, there's a note in the program saying these are composite characters or liberties have been taken and so forth, so that the realities he's putting on stage are clearly coming through his channel and through his filters.
Do you ever think about moving away from comedy toward drama?
I dance back and forth. Rabbi Sam has comedy in it, but is not purely a comedy. Same is true of People's Violin. Feisty Old Jew is a comedy, but there's a lot of serious stuff in it as well. And some of the other stories in the cycle, you know, make me cry. My goal as an artist is to follow the impulse where it wants to go and try to not prejudge it, not say, oh, this is going to be funny, but to let each story go where it's going to go.
You say cycle.
You know, I've got about 8 or 9 of a dozen stories done. This is very slow work, so it's going to take another couple of years to finish the whole cycle, which will then be a book and an audio book.
How'd you get work doing audio tours of museums?
Well, Myra, my partner of 30-plus years, knew Harriet, and Harriet worked at Antenna, which did audio tours. That's how I began many years ago.
Do you like doing them?
I love doing audio tours.
How much Charlie Varon can you put into an audio tour?
You know, I've been asking myself that same question. So right now, I think, what is there anything? Yes, I'm the voice of the Keith Haring audio tour at the De Young, and I also do the podcast for SF MoMA several times a year. I can't put the zany parts of myself, except if I'm doing, you know, a character, which is unusual in the narration. My goal is to respect the art that I'm discussing. It's a chance to serve other artists. I don't write it. I'm reading a script, but I'm trying to give what the writer sees in the work its fullest expression.
A couple other questions about Feisty Old Jew. Do you ever break the fourth wall?
What I found as we had a wonderful 5-month run of Feisty at the Marsh in San Francisco. The show evolved over the course of the run. I found myself between pieces. So I do Feisty, and then I talk for a little bit before I do a very short piece called Company. And I started bantering with the audience about some of the subjects in the – so it becomes much more interactive in – there's this almost – there's elements of stand-up and storytelling. It's telling how I happen to begin writing these pieces and, I mean, I talk about a little bit about my parents and their reaction to the stories. I'm not going to give it away. You're going to have to come see the show. But the biggest laugh of the night is always a line from my mom, which is her reaction to Bernie after reading the story. There's a lot of give and take, and in that sense, there's a kind of breaking of the fourth wall.
If you hear a cell phone during a performance, would you break the fourth wall?
It happened, the first time it happened, many years ago, some of the early days of cell phones, probably 15 years ago, I was in the middle of a scene playing, I don't know, two or three characters, and it was a very serious moment. And I all I could do was just wait till the phone stopped. Kind of go on automatic in those moments.
Right.
You don't really know what's – you just sort of something takes – and I said, I'm going to go back. And I went back to the beginning of the scene and got back on track. And that choice seemed fine. I don't know what I would do. I mean, that's why we tell people to turn off their cell phone.
Well, I mean, you can do it certainly when between the shows, but when you're in a play, you're not going to stop and have Bernie suddenly say, hey, listen, I'm telling this story, you guys.
Well, that maybe I'll, if it happens, I'll use your line. Yeah.
And finally, do you see yourself bringing Bernie back in another story?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I'm writing the sequel now. I don't have a title, but I'm writing the sequel. And it involves Bernie and one of the young people and Selma. I mean, this is the thing. These characters, they get inside me and they start telling me what's happening next in their lives. And I have to, all right. But I say, just wait, be patient. I've got another story. I'll get to you. I'm not doing you now, Bernie. Doing Adele, I'll get to you.
You've been listening to an interview with Charlie Varon, whose comedy is titled Feisty Old Jew, developed with and directed by David Ford. Feisty Old Jew plays at the Marsh, Berkeley Marsh, 2120 Alston Way in Berkeley. For more information, you can go to charlievaron.com or themarsh.org. And if you're a KPFA listener,
you get a big discount if you buy your tickets online by midnight tonight. For Feisty Old Jew, you will get a substantial KPFA discount because I love KPFA.
I'm Richard Walensky on Arts Waves, the Monday edition of Cover to Cover.